this pool, the last time I was at this pool at Orville, but I've been here for about 6 weeks, so it's a while for something. But I got to spend more time with my friend's little baby today, and beautiful babies are amazing. And so I wrote a poem about birds, and here it is. When two souls connect, the universe of creativity becomes one. White meets red, and the process of death and rebirth begins. As lovers hold each other's bodies, the soul of life grows through them. The dance of angels in enchanting clear form. Swollen bellies and full breasts, the creative essence of love and deep exchange. We hold on tight each other's grace. When babies are born, bonds are renewed, and the beauty of an infant's eyes gives peace to men of strength. The moment of new birth, the child has unlimited potential. They will shine out for the world to see, the essence of love and dance of life, and the flow of love emerging through the pitter-patter of tiny feet, the dance of a child coming into the world. Something that I've been doing for a year now, since July 2007, is I've been writing stream of consciousness writing every single day. Sometimes I do it in the morning and sometimes I do it later on in the day, but it's a great way for anybody who's writing to free up your creative blocks and to allow you to tap into that creative reservoir, if you like. But I've never read any of my stream of consciousness out of poetry. And I don't read it much myself, I just write it up. The idea is not necessarily to take anything from it, just to get it out. So tonight I'd like to read a page of my stream of consciousness. It might not make sense because it's just kind of whatever's pulling out, so forgive me, I'll read it and maybe it makes sense. People deeply loving ourselves as the play of form, the deep care of soul, the dramatic care and dream of what becomes manifest in our hearts. We love ourselves just as we are. All that I am, all that is taking place in my love of dream. The flow and care, the deepening meaning and realized process waiting out in my reveries. The flow of wills and its revelation, processing all our answers, the multiple worlds ever drawing us back to the start, freedom and process of what comes. This is what trance do keep warm. There can only be one letting go, flowing the energy, taking the place, giving us thanks, the underlying of what has been always realized. I am the care of that life. I am the care of that life. The dramatic monologue, it takes us back to the start of the part of it as a bird swoops over my head. The flow of possible answers and dreams of life. Discovery gives us thanks to that dream. I hold the love of my life within me. The answers unfold. We care to that dream of belonging. A unique level of process. I am established, found in my own path of world experience that takes us home. We are expressing out that deep level. The sun god speaks again. The establishment of our souls can tear out in a dream. So that kind of makes that. It was actually quite difficult to read that because I have never read it before. But I'm going to read one more thing, which is not my own words, but. How many people here have seen a film called The Mission? It's a beautiful film, and there's a part in the film where Robert De Niro kind of comes to the mission and he starts to read something from a book, and I found it very beautiful and very I've got a lot of solace from it, a lot of comfort from it. Though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, and I have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my gifts to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and have not love, it profited me nothing. Love suffered long and was kind. Love envieth not. Love flaunteth not itself. It's not puffed up. When I was a child, I speak as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. But now abide with faith, hope, love, these three. But the greatest of these is love.
Aaron, just a reminder that there is still a bunch of t-shirts up here. If you're not fine with that, just grab them. We'll take them on your way. Are there magazines at the end of the bar there? There are. Okay, there are some brochures, or magazine type brochures, about the Frank O'Connor Short Story Festival, which is on next September. We're talking about short stories earlier. And that's held here in the City Hall every year. It's a fantastic event. We're talking about the best short story writers in the world. It's one of the very top festivals of its kind. So help yourself to those three magazines there. It'll be in about a month's time from now. Next up to the mic, Brian or Moscow.
Dear, what are you doing here again? Is there something about this microphone? Stop. These all are looking at me, expecting me to say something. I am feeling it. That the one who thought he was all he was, to the one who is all there is, why am I here? Is this trembling here? Will it ever go away? And happiness.
Next up, we have Joe Queen. Hey!
Last April I was walking around the square in Blarney where I live, so it was 6 o'clock in the evening, and the sun was shining beautifully, and suddenly the air was full of bird sound. It was just one of those amazing moments. It seemed the whole square came alive with the music. And this poem is called Bird Song in Blarney. Sweet, crisp notes crisscross the village green, clacking like needles, knitting the village together, the feathered spirits of the air break out in a sudden avian flaw of delight, asserting their territories from branch and rooftop, their polite counterpoint, their careless fanfares break onto the April air, lifting, lightening my heart. Buoyed with the sounds, I pass a grateful pilgrim beneath their singing shrines, serenaded by their songs, downloading their melodies as I go. Come the dead of winter, the memory of these earnest minstrels may resurrect my joy, their ancient beats speak to me of spring again, in cold and silent night as I walk around the square. I shall hear them still, knitting with their notes again for me, a lovely sweater of sweet April
song. Next up to the open mic is Mr. Louis Mulcahy.
I just grabbed when I was coming out tonight because I had a few things in front of me. And I'm looking back at the moment at a relationship, and these were written at various times. Sun, shimmering beauty, fresh and clear, spreads radiant over through the land. Gone fitful storms of wind and rain, and sodden sober days that bridge the months and summer's end. Clothes on clotheslines, crisp and dry, breath hangs silver just ahead. Grass rides the squelch of drenching months, and spiders gleam on dormant branch. Hearts shed their cold, dreary grey. With arid eye and avid soul, shut senseless seeds with brief respite, plummet to their deepest core to surge at every manifest, from south to east draps even sore. Thus, when weary of dispute, when you said white and I said black, good nature's balm flows from your eyes, and shimmering beauty, fresh and clear, spreads radiant over and through the land. My love is like my loved one's hair that started straight and rusty red, is convoluted grey with lengths of years in bond and marriage spent. Growing strong and cared for daily, oiled and brushed and kissed by light, of love the steam and warm affection, it rolled about some scalding passion. Now combed for hint the black old tint, with mine is tangled in night and morn, its roots more deep in every way than first I fell beneath her lay. This is the one that I'm afraid I might have read before. The sun, the hill, and you. The westering sun turns pink the poles that hold the wire around the fields. The fields that cling to life by grass and fern and fern root in the hill. The hill that climbs from our back door to hoist the heaven's weight. From on the left above there, the sun comes late upon our lives. And as now from out in front it lights those posts from low above the sea, I turn to look it in the eye and am blinded by its smile before I blink. How often have I turned and caught that look, not from the setting sun, but you with whom I wrangle daily, from first that warms my ears to when it swings the heavens round, suffusing my whole day with breath and warmth.
Thanks, Louis. Next up we have Bree Buffy. Bree?
Hi, this is a short story that I had to write in a class. We were just getting postcards, and we had to write something on it, so mine was just a postcard of a geisha, a picture of a geisha, and it's a bit weird. I'll just say pause, because it just goes from one scene, one place, to the next, so I'll just say pause whenever it goes up. Moons dispose me in a vacuum. Only the stars are out tonight. The clouds all scurried away to fill a beagle's dreams. She lies on her side, but not in the fetal position one would normally assume. Somehow her spine retains its constant straight posture. Only her neck curves in order to see the moon more clearly. It is late, but her eyes have not yet surrendered their lupine roundness to the crescent shape of sleepiness. Hair remains twisted tightly in tendrils above her face. A stream of moonlight streaks across silky black hair, making her for a moment reminiscent of the bride of Frankenstein. She is oblivious of this. All she sees is the moon. All she hears is a single phrase of melancholy lyre repeating itself absurdly and without pleasure in her mind. Pause. The two lie on their backs in their four-poster bed, staring up at the ceiling. It is morning time, and the sun catches on their focus, the glass chandelier above them. All the sun's effort seems spent on the slightly swinging fixture, while the rest of the room remains in relative grey by the streaks of white and black offered by the shadows and reflections of the chandelier. Spider leg cracks spoke out of the ceiling around the chandelier. We really ought to get that scene to love, she said. No response. She turned her tassels in the yellow to him, lines dirty her brow, lips lower in irritation. Love, are you even listening? A grunt of affirmation fails to heed. She raises herself onto her side, cheek cupped in her hands, and smiles thinly at him, the effort widening the cracks on her face. Okay, I'll get on to it, she says with a smile, and places a hand on her cheek. She tells herself that it's Isaac's smile. Pause. And left, and down, and swoop, and race, and turn, turn, I said, with a hop she glides towards the terrified-looking Michael, who is trying her best to look precisely the opposite, with little success. The other girls go silently, keeping their gaze straight ahead lest they draw attention to themselves. She grabs the girl's arm roughly at the elbow and shoots. A stifled gasp escapes her. This is how we turn a fan. Pay attention, girls. She draws closer to the girl who is fiercely fighting the tears that prick her eyeball of the text if she's ready. Her face is so close that the girls can smell the rice powder and oil from Unisan's moon face. Her breath is so close that the girl forgets her whereabouts for a fleeting moment, finding herself in a field of lavender. Being past the peak of her thing's beauty would not subdue him in desire for personal perfection. She glares at the girl for a second and then whispers in her ear, Sakar-chan, are you a geisha or a jock? She almost skips the last word, warming her student's ear and face. She returns to the top of the room and the Michael resumes their dancing. Their only sound looks to the window, her eyes immediately drawn to the moonless evening sky of navy, her eyes resonant and languor dull. Pause. To feign the latent dinner table, she clasps the telephone receiver. She already knows before the click that it's her husband. She knows before he says a word that he is calling to say he's a bit caught up at work again and that he won't be home till late. That's fine, honey, she says, trying her best to sound like it is. Fingers that Ivy twins on the wire pull tightly when it is her turn to speak. Love you. She balks at the tone of her own voice. I sound like a bloody stepford wife. She does what she does every time she feels uncomfortably close to the edge, looks at their son. Mummy, is Daddy late again? He shouldn't get any dinner. The boy goes to the closet to dine, and for a moment envy that he should wear the posture she feels tucked up inside her and loves her. But as usual, she composes herself, butterflies with closed wings wrapped in a fist. Always let a man come to you, that's what her mother had always said. Lock a bird up and it will always just keep banging his face into the window trying to get out. She always left the window open a crack, but not too much. She feared that somewhere inside her knew she opened it and where that he flies without looking back. Pause. The moon is the last thing she sees before she drifts away. The moon that had always been there. Moon of her childhood, moon of her womanhood, moon of her past, moon of her present, moon that had witnessed her birth and would light the way for death's carriage, moon that had watched with benevolence on the day she became a geisha, moon that had sustained her sin. The moon that at its fullest had a countenance twinned by her own. The moon that wiped dwarfed behind her in the beat of blackest night. Pause. A postcard, with this in his hand, a postcard of a painting, not a real person. Still, he wishes he could be inside its borders, in its acacia stand, peacock quill in hand beneath the cherry blossom tree, the black bough trees in the full bloom. It sheds petals like confetti over the figure, some fall in her hair at winter night sky, jeweling it with stars. She is dressed traditionally, her lips are a streak of red on a white canvas. A full moon stands sentinel in the left top corner of the postcard, the figure's face turned towards us. A postmark on the right corner spells Osaka in English, and in the semi-familiar, semi-filled jumble to him, hieroglyphs of Japanese. He flips it over, but it is blank. He peers at the white surface intently, and with a deep exhalation closes his eyes, traces his fingers softly over the blank surface, as if he could feel the words he could not see. What foolishness to think that by wishing it, he could make the words not written become real. A cough, followed by a knock upon the slightly ajar study door. Hasn't he shut that door like he always did? Honey, his wife says, with a crack in her throat. Another cough. Just a moment, dear. He spins to his wife in the swivel chair, opens the drawer, hastily places the card inside the book in the drawer, and waits for her to enter. Pause. Lee confuses her wounds, weighing them down. She goes deeper into herself and awakens in a dream. It's springtime, and she is walking through the Kia garden towards the cherry blossoms at the border. She walks in silence for what seems like an eternity, but seems to make little progress. Time and space stretched and folded within the immateriality of thought. Everything is black except for the cherry blossoms, which have a ghostly glow that illuminates from within rather than by any outside source. The scene possesses an air of exaggerated silence, often found within dreams. Air is crisp and sharp like frost and a strange scent fills her, a blend of cherry blossom and something else she can't quite put her finger on. She looks up to the east with the stars and moon are nowhere to be seen, the sky streak of black ink. Panic prickles her skin, she begins to run, feels her breath come faster and shallower, but she cannot hear it. She trips and falls, landing on something soft and cold. Snow! So that has been the other scent of the air, snow and spring? Before she's up, she's somewhere else. On her knees by the river, peering over the edge of the bank, she cannot see her reflection, though her face is just inches above the water's surface. In frenzy, she looks for the moon's face in the water's dark surface, but is nowhere to be found. Panic climbs like ants up her neck and face. She splashes water on her face in desperation, eyes skim the water again. She recoils in horror. There is the moon, and there is her reflection. But it is the moon's face, and not her own, that sits atop her bare shoulder. She wakes with a start, relief wrapped around her for a moment. Just a dream. She turns on her side, looks out the window, sees a familiar glow. Her gaze lingers for a moment and then moves to the clock on the wall. Her stomach clenches. Why hasn't her alarm gone off? Her client will be here in an hour. She has so much to prepare. In a swoop, she's at the wardrobe, swinging its doors open with violence. A red kimono and a black kimono hanging within. Her eyes dart from black to red and red to black again. She reaches out and touches the silk of both, caught in irreparable indecision. She knows she must hurry, but something prevents her from deciding. She looks back at the clock. An hour has passed imperceptibly fast. A knock at the door. Panic. Her eyes dart from black to red. Red to black. The alarm clock rings. She starts, banging her head on the bedside locker. Pause. Does that mean you're asking me in for coffee? He teases with a cheeky grin, accompanied by conspiratorial wink. But I just met you at a party. I'm a good Catholic girl, you know, not on my birthday. She wags a finger at her husband coyly. But isn't this day three? Sister, are you looking for coffee or coffee? He leans in for a kiss, but she pulls away teasingly and he stumbles into the bedroom door, banging his forehead. The two erupt into drunken laughter. Hush, hey now, it's okay, I'll kiss it better. She touches his cheek, planting a kiss on his forehead, tilts his chin with a light touch so his lips meet hers. Pause. She allows herself the indulgence for a moment. Calls his face to hers in her mind's eye and then pushes it back roughly. She tightens her undergarments with two forceful pulls, angered that she should let herself feel softly for him, be it only for a moment. She resigns herself to achieve perfection in her dress, nothing less. Her clients will be here shortly. Had she thought she would load herself with grace to Isa, taking clients to her bed 5 years ago, she would have slapped her own face into that mess, but she still wears a robe on the back that was along the front of her kimono. When a bad thing is done once, it is surprisingly easy to do it again. She tells herself she will be beyond perfect for her client tonight. She will make him stick with desire. She will make her client feel everything she wants the first man she labels to feel. She will make him feel all she felt but could never say. How dare his existence bring so much pain? How dare he name her and then walk away? Why must she endure where men enjoy? She sits in front of the full-length mirror, painting her face in white. if only her existence brought him as much sorrow as his did hers, if she had the power to hurt him, if only she could make him hurt. Once you've reached the top of the mountain and driven in the giddy heights, it's hard to turn around and go back. But he'd done it with such ease and left her to the wolves. She strips the crimson on her lips and lies and closes her lips tightly. If only she can make him hurt. And there's a knock on the door. Oh. There are bodies moved in the mouth, a glow from the window silvers their sweating skin. As usual, she is above him. Her hands are on his chest, his hands are at his side. Both their eyes are closed. They are almost at the end. It has become the race to the goal. She rocks back and forth, biting her lip in pleasure. The bed moves with them, bedposts knocking at the wall noisily. Both of them are past noticing that there are changes in the way all are in love. But he is further away. To him, his wife isn't even there. A traditional shamisen tinkles in his mind, a singing voice intoxicates him, the sound of silk falling to the floor, the taste of her skin, the scent of her hair, the warmth. He opens his eyes and sees charms of life falling. He does it without a thought, throws his wife off him, but doesn't have time to save himself as the chandelier hurtles towards him. A gasp escapes his lips, his wife gives a blood-curdling scream. She is mesmerized for a moment, but then frantically pushes with all her might. She somehow manages to force the mainframe off the shatter on the floor, but several shards of glass protrude from his chest. His breathing is shrill and shallow, with left lungs punctured. Shattered crystals are jewels his chest, blood flows from each wound, trickling down to clear his abdomen. He watches the blood puddle without resistance and drift away into himself, the final image in his mind before it all goes black with a crimson mist. His wife straddles his dead body, beats his chest with her fists, and then pulls his limp body towards her. He loves me, he loves me, he loves me, she whispers, clinging their two bodies, her arms wrapped around him in a final embrace. Pause. He stands by the window. The suited businessman walks towards her, intoxicated by her beauty. He wraps his arms around her tightly. She flinches a little. Her eyes above his shoulders fixate on the moon as a black cloud slides across it, obscuring it in view. She falls down and finds herself.
Thank you. Next up we have Mr. Mario Ferrier.
Evening. This is a mini story called Politics the Parish and the Parish Priest. And it's a fictionalized version of something, a story I heard when I was a child. And it may have happened, it may have actually happened, but I've just embroidered it. It's splendid, multicolored tropical plumage was suffering badly in the dank overcast surroundings of a small grey town in the west of Ireland. This lord of the jungle treetops of Amazonia, casting a rueful beady eye around his new abode, had decided in protest to molt permanently. Bad idea in the chilly County Clare winter. Grandmother knitted a rainbow-coloured striped poncho for poor, shivering Valentino. She was torn between showing him off to her friends or hiding him away in the back room, for this parrot had a foul mouth. He had, it was said, spent several months on board a rusty old tramp steamer in the company of the ship's first mate, whose favourite expression delivered in perfectly enunciated Welsh tones was, "You old fuck, ah, you!" Valentino the parrot had been sold without a trace of sentiment to a pet shop in a town in South Wales to help along with a drinking spree. Although a well-brought-up lady, Granny Clare, who was staying with relatives, had been secretly amused by this feathered ruffian's bad language in the pet shop, where she had gone with the intention of buying a sweet-voiced budgie. Her brother and sister-in-law had been quite shocked, and there were indignant cries, "Get that bird out of my house!" Ah, such innocent times. Anyway, Valentino, after a spell, literally in the abandoned doghouse, chained up to prevent him seeking sunnier climes, found himself in the hyper-saturated west of Ireland. Those were the times of strange Irish Civil War hangover. It was in between that rough and ready phase of communication, where communication was carried on with guns, first with our long-time masters from across the water, and then amongst our own people. And the later mohair suited phase where the wheels of Irish politics and business were lubricated with large dollops of backhander grease. In those days, Up Dev was guaranteed to draw out the famous Clare shout, otherwise reserved for the winning of hurling matches. Or else, if used in the wrong company, it could elicit sour looks or even start a good scrap. Some people took the death of Michael Collins, the big fella, personally and blamed it on the long fella, De Valera. Granny Clare was not particularly political, but she was partial to drama. So she was determined to teach Valentino to say, Up Dev. She spent many hours at this, but was usually rewarded with a stream of ear-scorching nautical obscenities by the disgruntled parrot, trying to ruffle out his rainbow poncho in the absence of feathers. One day, the parish priest, Father Mac, an avid supporter of De Valera, was visiting the house. He was tucking into a seat of fatty bacon and cabbage and big sour spuds from the garden, liberally smeared with salty homemade country butter. No wonder the priest's face glowed if he had that kind of feed in every house he visited, and perhaps washed down with a tumbler of whiskey in some houses. Granny came in carrying the parrot in his cage. Father, he's just learned to say Up Dev, she burst out excitedly. Good, good, a true patriot, even if he is an interloper from some savage, godforsaken part of the world. He'll probably say it again. Come on, Valentino, Up Dev. Father Matt tut-tutted his disapproval at the name of the celluloid ladies' man and advised that the bird should be renamed Patrick. Well, why not Martin, after Martin IV, the black saint, so popular in Ireland at that time? Everyone strained to hear the parrot, who was muttering inaudibly while turning a beady eye from one to another in the room. Up Dev, squawked the parrot. You old fuck are you?
Next up we have Saskia Byrne. Saskia.
Some of us had a lot of fun at the green gathering last weekend.
I like that.
We were kind of wondering what we would call the poetry that we decided to call Earth Poetry. So I kind of decided I like that. And I'm going to call this Earth Poetry, and these three poems are called Silver. Under the tight bud of a new moon, a delicate promise, born of a silver dancing river, rushing seaward, spilling delight into an ocean of wandering. Among black vassals I lay remembering, deep and fairy, where the hosts carry their devotion, like a fragrant flame, washing over the dark goddess who rides atop a white and swarthy stallion in the midst of Avalon. The smoky landscape dusted in the frosty air, the nectar of those whirling revelers snaking their way to the mother core, reminding me of the perfect dance that was never forgotten, and piece by piece we reclaim that which we thought was lost but never was. And wave upon wave, we turn and spin and fill the narrow confines of who we thought we were, breaking free forever. We count our coup and dream and summon and intend. Spirit and flesh converge. Next one. I'm held on the ancient palm of land, crisscross the lines of power, hold my intention. Peace above, below, around, the joyful leap of silver water. Unheard melodies. What people once stood here were melded into this holy place of holy well. I feel their presence watching that I might breathe the land like once they did and slip quietly into the beauty that washes over me and over them. A continuous unbroken line of living spirit wisdom transcends the place where silence dwells. Invisible hands of windswept hawthorn and the risen holly tree. Full-throated song of robin, guard, hair strewn across faces, stuffy noses leaking boots. Who cares? We made it there, above the gushing stream, in full flood. above the bobbing boats in Safe Harbor, up slidy river roads, bracing slapping wind and stinging rain, a moment in a fairy force, one pause to feel the ancient thread woven into the land, still fed by beauty.
Every word is true of that. I was there. Smashing down in Wexford. Next up to the mic, we have Eugene Crowley.
Is on Clara, Jewish Island, purchased by Christianity, Friends Meeting, Outcast Union. Once visited, Scott Machine Memories, Clara the Deer, Witness Astuteness, Thomas, Temple and Talus, she made.
Good luck up to Eugene. And next up, Mary O'Sullivan. Mary.
Yay. I'm more confident now, I think. Okay, so I'm going to do two poems. The first one's called Essential. She looks at me, trying so hard to keep me up. Her hands touch. As I glance at her, she seems so elegant, confident, and joyous. I wonder why I am not like that. She reminds me of me, but a happier, more blessed version. I try to see me from her point of view. I look drawn and tired. Do I always look like that, so fed up and uninspired? As if she senses what I am thinking, I feel her giving me the strength to carry on. Suddenly I can see a lot of good things in my life. My first book, my travels, my family. When I notice she is no longer in front of me, but beside me. It is at this point that I realize that she is me. Or rather, me as I should be, the friend that I need to carry me through and fill my soul, my essential self. The inspiration is magnetic. This next one's called Warning, and I think it's going to be kind of relevant because poets and the meaning of words to all of us, so. Hope you like it. Words, meaningless, empty, hollow, fulfilling, hopeful, inspiring, essential. They tumble from me, unbeknown to me, the impact that they leave all around. Perhaps if I put more thought into my words, but they jump from me. I don't seem to control them, it seems rather that they control me. This is the frightening part, this acknowledgement. Now I know, I feel as if I should warn others. I should come with a warning label. Careful. Free-falling words. Side effects may include hurt feelings, lower self-esteem, confusion over recent events. I come with a warning label.
Thank you, Mary. Next up we have... Well, this is a very time for a veil, I think. Stefan Zenger. Stefan.
Hi there. So I'm going to read a poem that I wrote like 7 years ago, and hopefully I can remember it. And if I can't, I'm going to blame the people who wickedly, wickedly encouraged me to get up here and do One day in the summer sometime, when I was 5, I looked down at the ground and I found something. Or I found what I thought was a something. Bent in stature, but bent on capturing my movements on the ground like some ethereal ink, this was, I learned, my shadow. And that's what I came to call it, my shadow. Even though it wasn't really part of my body. In fact, it wasn't part of anything. It wasn't a something at all. It only existed to the eye. The shadow was just what happened when I stood in the way of the sun and looked down. And my parents assured me it carried no weight, no substance. but all the same I carried it around. In truth, I came to think of it as just as real as me, that it could be as heavy as my imagination decreed. I took my shadow everywhere with me, walked and it walked with me, ran and it followed, shadow traced me and tracked me, shadow called to me from tall trees and back alleyways and mystic poetry. I don't quite know where it learned to shout or snicker so. I don't know where it picked up that menacing grin, changed its name, became fond of disguises, but it howled at me when the sun sets, and it menaces me when it rises, and it visits me on unfamiliar streets, and stalks me from the treetops, and I've come to watch out for it, I've come to fear its names, come to give a new name, come to give my fear new names, like devil or demon or hungry ghost, Saturn or hell, where the deep fires roast. You know, in the past sometimes, some philosophers or priests, they looked around and they found something, or they found what they thought was a something. And they too came to think of a shadow as something more. They too knew fear and ran from it in horror. They saw horns and fangs and scales in that empty, shady space. They saw the faces of their enemies. They saw their own disgrace. And they gave it their own names, and they taught those names to their children. And boogeymen crawled out from under beds, and monsters out from closets, and children suffocated in their beds and hid themselves in closets, and we hide ourselves and suffocate in beds and hide in closets so the shadows don't come back, so the shadows don't attack. When I was 6 years old, my cousin told me about the devil, and I laughed in his six-year-old face. The notion was so absurd. Where did you get your information, man? Is it something you saw in a cartoon? Seems like one of the games that grown-ups play, like Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny, but not the kind of game that anybody would laugh at. If only I kept on laughing, if only I kept on trusting, if only I kept on trusting laughing, and I could have kept my joy from rusting. Because when I was 6 years old, I laughed at the devil, and I think that the devil laughed back. And when I was 6 years old, I laughed at the devil, and I think the devil laughed back, because now I cower in the shadows, and I feel things in the air, and I see such somethings in the waters beneath me. I feel the river of emotions growing too cold, too cold, too cold around me. And I want to jump out of the cold, cold waters. I want to jump out of the shadows, man. I want to jump out of sweat-soaked suspensions, uninvited shivers, and whirling backward glances. Am I thick yet? Am I strong enough? Am I cool enough? Am I blessed right? Am I taking the right turns? Am I fighting the good fight? Am I shaking the right handshakes or kissing the right babies? Will they fear me? Will they hurt me? Will love come in time to save me? These are just a few of the names I've given to fear. I've given so many names to fear. I've given so many reasons to fear. I've given so many fears to fear itself, and I want to start naming something else. And sometimes I want to get rid of my shadow. That would mean I'd have to stop standing underneath the sun, because the shadow is what happens when you're standing away from the sun. And just because the shadow is too cold, it doesn't mean you can jump out of it. Maybe we can get used to it. Surprise, surprise, we can handle it. It's just a shadow. And the shadow is just what happens when you're standing in the way of the sun. So the shadow is just what happens when you're standing in the way of the sun. So close your eyes. Close your eyes and feel the sun. And close your eyes until you and the shadow are one. Thanks.
Are you still there? Next up to me on the mic, Patricia Walsh.
Thank you, Paul. I wrote this poem a couple of days ago. I don't know how many of you have been affected by the recent floods. Hands up? Well, I come from Mallow, and around the time of year, Mallow gets bears the brunt of a lot of floods, so... I was 2 meters high at least. So, Chocolate River. Swollen, angry, one-sided. Wonka's nemesis strides, full, knowing, leading itself onto higher ground. This is not just a flood. This is clamor releasing. The fish only has eaten, die in all directions. Throughout the traffic homes and shopping trolleys. Our necessities bounded by the rage of ingratitude.
being curtailed for convenience by our own people. We now consider spring leaks, our birth bellies, one-sided, swollen, angry, curtailed, breaking the rules. Thanks.
Hey, Patricia. Sorry, Leon. I have to say this now because can I have a pint, please? Thank you very much. Next up to the open mic, we have Sue Blue. Sue. Is it Derek? But he's definitely deaf. And he's from Galway, and he says, sorry. His name is Sean. And he's glad to meet you all, and he has to go. And thanks very much for a good time. Thank you, Sean.
Might not stand to him, but anyway, I'm going to be quick yeah. Hello. Sue Blue. The U.S. is Irish Green Gathering, a couple of us this weekend. It was soaking, and I was actually sick, and I had my daughter with me, and the tent was soaked, but it was a great time anyway. One night, one of those nights, we were sitting in this family campsite, because we were picked up in the family campsite, which is not, and we were sitting around the fire that we pulled up, and it was really cozy and really nice, and Paul and I had bought sheepskins, and Paul was going to sleep in the sheepskins, and the people around the fire were asking me for a second round of poetry, and I read them the following poem, which I was greatly encouraged to do the introduction to, so I'll do that first. Find it. This paper here, thing I'm holding, I did in 2000, and it's a collection of poetry that I published on my own account. I don't think it ever went around much, and I don't have any copies left, but anyway. Okay, I wrote this poem at the fire, and the following instructions greatly appreciated. I was in the States in 1990-91, and I was out in the Midwest of America. I was in Missouri living with a Baptist family in a place called Liberty, Missouri, quite near Kansas City. At 16, I just come from a phase of Christianity into a phase of criticism. And I was living with a Baptist family, right? Both my parents were involved greatly in the village or town, and they were involved in the school system, so being everyone in town. And my father was a junior high counselor, and my host mom was an elementary school teacher in the place, so they knew every kid in town. And if there was anyone they didn't know about, they were sure able to find out, and they would, because I was connecting up with the wrong kind of people. Anyway, we had an assignment in creative writing class about personifying. So we were supposed to personify something, and I decided, because I was living in America, coming from Germany, to personify superficiality. Right? So I went to my host mom, and I said, Mom, how would you personify superficiality? And she said, personify? And I said, well, personify is as if you would write about something as a person, describe something as a person. And I said, how would you personify superficial people? And she said, well, they kind of dye their hair green and wear black and all that, you know? And I was like, Jesus Christ, I was coming from a phase of criticism. I was 16, just for the plunks, right? So anyway, I went away and I decided to write about superficiality just by myself. Superficiality. Cool. Breathtakingly handsome. He walks down the stairs to the lengthened hall, a cigarette in his hand. His smile and friendliness charm the makeup faces. Eyes brighten. Conversations of ladies in circles pause for a while. With champagne in their hands, freezes for a second. While desirous eyes glide down his grey suit, down a straight crease and up to his knowing eye. His own just go by those who do not look. He had the choice. Let his eyes wander across the room, full of expectancy. He picks out a face, places down the last step, takes the chosen lady's hand, and speaks with a smoky voice. I'll give you all tonight. I'll pay for anything. You might. My jumper is awaiting us. Then turns around, guides his selection towards the door. The crowd moves as he exhales the last puff. And they disappear, leaving discomfort and a cold wind.
Take it to the room. Next up to the mic, we have first time to a bell, Kate McGrew. Kate? Oh yeah, sorry, you had a collateral.
You're
going to
pay the water fees.
So, I try and only curse when it provides a bit of nice alliteration. Fuck the facts! Just, I will be fabulous! And do it without knowing, cause I know more is less! So much trouble in the world of fake stress! Fuck the facts! Stress, I will be fabulous! Once lost cuddles and left for death down in blind, my mind's devices, lost devices, yo, I couldn't even write shit. Now spit delicate encryption, I spit pics of prediction, like a prophet writing scriptures on a mission. The condition of our current state lacks vision. My dread on mind tricks free from submission. I'm listening for the storm of watching by the colored form. The masses huddle in the dark and mark time and just wait for the alarm. So fuck the bat, stress. I will be fabulous. And do without dough, cause I know more is less. So much trouble in a world of fake stress. Fuck the facts. Stress, I will be fabulous. You're stupid, not dead, so stand still. My words come out hard like an anvil. Cancel what you heard on the street. I'm producing a lyrical scandal. Go to the vandal, ring fire. To the fire you must have heat. I will not be beat or law or treatment. I think that's what I thought. Culture addict, dim, fat. But didn't make it further. I like it like that. So fuck the fact. I will be fabulous. And do it without dough, cause I know more is less. So much trouble in a world of fake stress. Fuck the facts. Stress, I will be fabulous.
Well, thank you, Judy Paper Blue. And next up we have Miriam Casey.
So depressed. It is the hard to stay on record in Rome. Gaius Livius, beloved of the gods, took the acclaim of his people. He was their pride, young, strong, virile, a great soldier, and also well known for his accomplishments in the arts. Truly, he was one of the greatest leaders that Rome has ever brought forth. His name evoked fear in his enemies. His ruthless campaign had brought back riches, slaves, and great power. He was a god. He loved his people, and his people loved him. The two gladiators in the area below were waiting for his signal. The emperor regarded them keenly. One was the man that the people called Morento, found in the outer provinces, and had given Gaius Livius and his people many hours of pleasure and prowess with the trident and net. The man reeked of death. His muscles expanded and contracted in the sun like a relentless march, and every movement of his down the tiny slipper demanded acknowledgement and respect. Gaius had never known such a fighter, and this, his last one, promised to be the best. The people of Rome had, in honor of the festival of the great god Mars, demanded his release, and Gaius Livius, ever sensitive to the needs of the people, had offered no resistance. The gladiator's opponent had risen in a very short time to the ranks of stardom in the gladiator circle. What he lacked in speed and agility, he made up for in brutality and sheer force. Marius was his name, and Gaius knew that he soon placed Morento in the people's esteem and favor. A hush rapidly descended as the emperor took one last look around at his people and lowered himself onto his chair while making signals for the gladiators to begin. The fight was ferocious, and the sun burned down on top of all seemed to make every action of the fighters more intense and ominous. There seemed to be no way of ending. The opponents had already sized up the measure of each other and fought blow against blow, reprisal against reprisal. The blood poured down the body of each man to fall like raindrops from the parched ground. Caius felt as if he was transfixed in the sheer charge and spectacle. He could not drag his eyes away. Suddenly, the sun and the long hair of the giant Morento seemed to give the uncanny illusion that the man seemed to be on fire, and in a moment a cry came from him as he fell motionless to the ground. Before Caius could react, Marius was kneeling on the man, poised an arm ready to raise for the kill. He looked up straight into the eyes of Caius Livius. Caius stood up to receive the response of the people. In union, they raised their voice to chant, "Hail Caesar! Let him live! Let him live!" Caius smiled at them all with fatherly devotion and prepared himself to make the song's down sign to spare Morento. But in horror, he suddenly became conscious that he was bringing his thumb off instead. With a roar of triumph, Marius cut Morento's head off with his sword and swung it round to show the people in the dazzling sunlight with a smile of relentless delight. There was not a sound from the spectators, and Caius felt himself standing watching the mage with the sun pouring down on his head and his own eyes staring straight into the accusing ones of the severed head of Morento. Suddenly Caius became aware that the spectators' doors were empty. The people had all left him standing there. Marius had left too, taking with him the severed head. The days dragged on, each day hotter than the last. Marius had been murdered, and his body unceremoniously thrown into Tiber. The guards around the palace had been doubled, and Gaius knew that the army was still loyal to him and his men. On the streets was another story. The people were afraid. There were riots on the streets. Rumours abounding of food shortages and consequent price increases were alarming and maddening them. The temperature continued to soar. Rape and other crimes of violence had escalated. Caius' slaves had spent between going over and over again those final fatal moments and dealing with the consequences of the act. The army wanted to subdue the people, imprison them, kill them if necessary, to offer deterrence against the looting and destruction. But Caius held off. Caius had had Morento's head and body united and buried secretly in the great temple of Apollo. He had ascended himself, which had not prevented the days from getting hotter and hotter. The army was getting impatient with Caius. Rome was becoming a melting pot of terror and rape. There were also stirrings from the nearby provinces. They were beginning to become aware of the circumstances and were preparing to take advantage. And yet Caius could not bring himself to unleash the army on the people. He was haunted by nightmares at night. The head of Morento had been replaced by other heads, times when Caius himself had killed, assassinated, and murdered. The heads of those tonight are beginning to fill today. Tomorrow is the last day of tribute to the god Mars. His advisors had encouraged him to triple the number of gladiator fights to appease the people, but Caius had decided to have none. There was nothing but theatre and oration. The day arrived. The sun was soaring. High as Lily's watched the people from the day. The atmosphere was mutinous. Many had died from the intense heat. In the light, you could clearly read the expressions of distrust and hatred on the faces of those people. And he knew that it was all aimed at him. The fragility and ferocity of life seemed all around him, and the knowledge of his own weaknesses seemed to taunt him. On the moment Lichaia stood up and prepared to speak, he would tell the people by his deeds the fact that there had been no deliberation on his part to act against them, but that he had been under the auspices of the gods, the faith. Suddenly Lichaia felt a drop in his head. Looking up, he saw that the sky was still a clear and dazzling blue, with the sun shining straight down. But as he widened his field of vision, he saw the dark and heavy clouds of rain beginning to cover the sky. As unconsciously Caius Livius raised his arm to give thanks, he heard the resounding salute of the people. Hail Caesar! Hail Caesar! Hail Caesar!
Heavenly, I can fly. Please up your place in the court, why lie me?